Hey, welcome, everybody. Is this not on?
Look at you with bent knees.
Huh?
Look at you.
I know, it actually works. And I wondered the other day how come it didn't hurt anymore, and then I remembered it was metal, so.
Amazing.
I know, it's really nice. Well, welcome, everyone. It's good to have everybody out. Let's see. We've got four people that are not here today. Jeff Turley and Dean Quayle and Cecilia Benson and Roger Jones have asked to be excused. So we'll move on and do make a motion to accept the minutes and approve the agenda.
I shall move.
Second?
I'll second it.
Thank you.
I have a change on the minutes.
Okay.
On line 56, it says, it's Holly Broomhire introduced, Ron Natale presented, and Todd Buehler assisted. Actually, that's Ron Natale and Todd Buehler presented. Now, Todd didn't assist.
Okay.
He presented.
All right.
Other than that, that's the only change I have.
Okay.
As amended.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, thank you. Okay, next board meeting is Tuesday, May 28th. So mark that down so you don't forget.
We really need a quorum, so please come.
Yeah, I think we're going to be a little short that month, so everybody needs to come that can get here. Yeah, a little short.
It's the day after Memorial Day.
Huh?
It's the day after Memorial Day.
Oh, that's right. Okay, there's why we're short. Okay, do we have any questions or comments for management? And I just blew it. I was supposed to put in there that I'm changing the agenda to move the service presentation up under the district marketing report. So do I need to do a whole new accept?
Yeah.
So with that change, do we have a motion to accept the agenda?
I move to do so.
Okay, do I have a second?
I second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay. All right, so we'll go down to item six and have an update on the district marketing report. We have Jeff Olson here.
He is.
Where is he?
Chad, he's first, actually. I need to have him go first. Yeah, we need Jeff. Jeff's first.
Okay. Hold on.
Do you want to do a marketing or a service report right now?
How about we just scrap the agenda and see what's next?
Just play it by ear, huh?
Yes.
Sean, do you want to do the service report while we're finding?
Yeah, if I'm not breaking too many
rules. Oh, wait, here he is. Okay. All right. Yeah, I don't want to break the rules. So.
Chad, we need to switch that out. Go ahead, Jeff. You're up.
Maybe while we're waiting for Jeff's computer to get hooked up, just as a reminder to the board, and some of you may not have been here when Rumor came last time. So this is Jeff Olson from Rumor Advertising. They're the firm that we've contracted with to help us with a marketing plan to increase ridership, to reach out to the community, engage the community and stuff. And so they've been actively doing a lot of things for us. And so the board had asked that on a quarterly basis, we have some type of update on the marketing report. And so we felt we kind of started a lot of this in March. And so we felt that, although it hasn't been a quarter since all of that got up and going, we felt there was enough significant things that we wanted to get Jeff up here to give us an update. And so with that, we'll turn it over to Jeff.
Great. Thank you, Todd. Is this working?
Okay.
Can I have just really?
Okay. There we go. Yeah, it's great to be back meeting with the board. A lot has happened on the marketing side of things since my firm was here last fall. We were just getting ready to launch our new website, and I think we gave you a little bit of a preview. But as Todd said, we want to kind of give you an update on what we've been working on these last few months. So we'll kind of do a quick, excuse me, refresher here. You may remember that we started by creating a strategic marketing plan. This is an integrated marketing plan for the full year. Ideally, this plan would stretch out over the next 2-3 years, but we understand the focus is on this year, 2019. With this marketing plan, there are a lot of things we've done. The goal is to help connect with your core audiences, the writers themselves, the registered voters, your elected officials, employees. And we want to try to convey the value of the Cache Valley Transit District to the community. These are some of the key goals and objectives of the plan: increasing ridership. There's, as everyone's been aware, there's been a little bit of a reversing or declining trend over the years. We want to help reverse that and increase the ridership and convey the incredible community value that these vital roles and the value that CVTD brings to the community. And the community engagement side. We want to get not only the active riders and the employees, but the registered voters, the citizens, and that very small minority who sometimes are vocal to embrace the district. So we started with the redesign of your website, and the goal, it seems so long ago now, this old site, but it was just a few months ago. We wanted to bring the design and the usability up to modern standards and make it very mobile friendly. The whole idea was to have information easily accessible at your fingertips and just simplify the whole website experience. Hopefully, most, if not all of you, have had a chance to go on the new website. It's a great experience whether you're using a desktop computer, and especially if you're using a mobile device, which we're seeing a very high concentration of visitors, our mobile users. And it's got these the robust rider tools, the trip planners, the routes and schedules, when's the next bus coming, et cetera. But it's very easy to use. And we've got the rider alerts and updates. We've got the air quality, all kinds of tools on there. So if you haven't checked out the new site, we encourage you to do that at cvtdbus.org. Lots of positive feedback from riders, community members, and others on the site. This is just one here. The new CVTD website is really easy to use and has improved the CVTD experience. That's Ryan Perez, a Cache Valley resident. And we've always, when we came on board, we looked at the website as an extension of your actual bus service. And it is such an integral part to the experience. So we're really happy to hear that the overall experience with the new website has been great. Next, as Todd mentioned, we have just recently rolled out an integrated marketing campaign. This started March 1st, so we're less than 2 months, but we're seeing some into the campaign. But we're seeing some pretty remarkable results. I'll get to the numbers in just a minute. So some of these campaign items include display advertising on Google. The message, and if you've seen any of the ads, if you've heard the radio spot, et cetera, go to the website. We're really driving home this theme of connection, that CVTD allows you to connect to the people, the places, the things that matter most, whether it's your livelihood, education, family and friends, whatever that might be. These banner ads have been displaying. We've got, I think, over 100,000 impressions. Ad impressions have been served, very targeted to only members of Cache Valley, so there's geo-targeting involved. And we're also people who come to the website, we're retargeting them. We're hitting them with these ads as a reminder to keep coming back. We're at pain. You've social campaign. If you're on Facebook, Instagram, there's a good chance you've seen some of these ads. Again, you know, connect to friendships, connecting to your livelihood. You click on this ad, for example, the livelihood, and it takes the viewer to see the park and ride locations, so they can see how convenient riding CVTD actually would be for a commuter. If there's a message about accessibility, we direct them directly to the accessibility page on the site. And you can see, in just a little less than 2 months, we've generated a little under 500,000 ad impressions on social media. That's quite a few for a population of 100 plus. So we're getting some good frequency and repetition. We have tracked so far over 10,000 engaged users on your social sites. So by engaged users, we mean people that are liking the ads, commenting, sharing, posting. So a lot of high engagement there, which is wonderful. Mm-hmm. And we've had almost 2,500 of these click through and go visit the website. So some great results there. We talked about last time we came that measurement of what we're doing is very important. And we have this digital marketing dashboard that's live and available 24/7, where you can look at, and I just did a screenshot. There's all kinds of data in here that we can look at, but I just wanted to give you a simple representation. So for our digital marketing campaigns, the data is real-time, available anytime. And we do send Todd regular reports as well on this. Some of you may have heard the radio ads that we've been doing. I'll play a sample here. And I haven't tested the volume, so we're going to keep our fingers crossed, see if it works.
Everyone's talking about how well.
Have most of you heard, seen some of these digital ads, heard the radio? Great. Well, we have more coming. We have some budget to do some additional designs, some additional ads, and we're going to be debuting a TV ad for you guys here in just a moment. So one of the amazing things we've seen, I wanted to show you this graph here. This first graph is on the left. This is visitors to your website. And the second graph is the number of page views. They look very similar, but I'll show you in just a minute. I'll show you how they work. So you can see that kind of that flat line there before March 1st, before we launched our marketing campaign. But beginning of March, as soon as we launched the campaign, you can see about a 10 times, about a 1,000% increase or a 10x increase in the number of visitors to your site and the number of pages that are being viewed on the website. So if you look at the numbers down below, in January, this is pre-campaign, there were 718 users on the site, 3,181 pages viewed, and the visitors were spending about a minute and 47 seconds on average on the site. February, pretty similar. The numbers were pretty similar. Look in March, we went from 550 in February to 5,523. So basically a 10 times increase. And then April's not a full month. This is data from the 19th. So this is still 10, This is a partial month we're showing for April, which we expect will top out well over March. But you can see, this is kind of cool. You can see a nice increase in pages per session, right? Before the campaign, it was about an average of 2 pages per visitor. Now we bumped that up to 3. You know, that doesn't seem like a lot, but that's actually pretty significant. And then the time spent on the site has gone from about 1 minute and 50 seconds to 2 minutes and 30 seconds. So we're driving a lot more visitors to the site. People are spending more time on the site, and which is great. And obviously, the ultimate goal is that increased awareness of the services the district provides, increased visits and traffic to the website, will translate to increased ridership. And that's something we'll correlate as we get a little bit more data with Todd and the team. We want to look at, okay, are these marketing dollars we're spending, how are they impacting the ridership? But so far on the front end, the front end numbers are really, really great. We might have talked through this with the board before, I can't remember, but we want the board to know that we provide accountability and transparency in all of the work we do. We know that, and especially as a public-funded entity using public funds, you have to be accountable for every dollar that you're spending. This is new for CVTD. And so as you see the reporting there, we're accountable on all of that, but also even on the traditional media, the radio ads, the television, if and when we do outdoor ads, et cetera. We have a process where, and we've already gone through much of this, the media planning, the client has approved it, the negotiation, and now we start running the campaigns, and every quarter we go back and do a post analysis with I think we're advertising with 5 radio stations locally right now. We've got Pandora and some others, and we go back to those stations and we make sure that we're getting every impression, that you guys are paying for. And so that's all part of the accountability as well. Another key area, obviously, is community engagement. I think most of you may have seen by now, I believe the Community Engagement Committee might have had a chance to share this city council and elected officials presentation with you. But the whole purpose of this is to, again, help the elected officials see the incredible value that CVTD brings to the community. This is a great presentation. It's great for council meetings. It can be done one-on-one as you're out meeting with other influential members of the community. Another thing, in fact, I think there's a couple posted on the door there. We're doing some CVTD branded apparel and some other items that are being used. I think last week Todd and the team had an event at USU with the Earth Day and had these shirts available. We'll be doing apparel and other things for your other community engagement events, the fairs, the parades, the festivals, the sporting events, etc. So what's next? We've obviously accomplished quite a bit in the first few weeks of the campaign. So transit advertising. So we just designed and approved, and it's going into production now, a full bus wrap, one of your hybrid buses, I believe. And it has that connect message, that campaign message. So we want to make sure that there's good repetition of the brand message in everything we're doing. And also we're designing some smaller bus board ads that will be available for when your advertising partner, Lamar, who sells your inventory on the buses, when they have unsold inventory, we can run the Cache Valley Transit ads at no additional expense for the district. The sponsorships. You have these in place with USU football, basketball, volleyball, the Eccles Ice Center, the five local high schools, but we'll be infusing some, and this is a mock-up, this isn't like Maverick Stadium or anything, so, but we'll be infusing some new designs and things into your sponsorships. I think we already have a new banner up at the Eccles Ice Center. And then television advertising. So there's a kind of a common feel or a common, attitude that riding the bus isn't, it's inconvenient, it's not cool, et cetera, right? And with this TV campaign that we're launching, we want to kind of reverse, change that mindset a little, that not only is riding CVTD cool and hip, but it'll help you connect with the things that are most important. So let's have a look and a listen. Pretty fun, huh? That kind of makes the experience look cool and convenient. So that's the first ad that will be. We have a TV campaign scheduled to launch in June, I believe, and run through the rest of the year. So if you have and it's targeted just here. So if you have Comcast, you'll see that ad. And then we're also going to be running this on Facebook and Instagram as well. And we have in the budget to produce at least one or maybe a couple more of these type of video ads for the year. So that's a little bit of an update and some of the results of what's happened so far. So again, really happy to be here and report to the board. And if you have any questions, let me know. And I want to be mindful of the schedule and the time too. So
does someone have questions?
I have two.
Jeannie.
Are you
yes.
going to wrap any of the Colloride buses, the smaller buses?
Todd, go ahead.
We don't wrap Colloride buses. So the Colloride buses are for persons with disabilities, and we've had concerns before that people have a hard time distinguishing them from, for example, CETC or Options for Independence buses. And so to deal with that, we make sure that they are unique, that they have logos placed in certain places.
Okay.
So for those reasons, we don't do any advertising on Colloride buses. It's a great question.
Okay. But. And my other question is, the last frame of your television advertising,
yes.
I know it was sunshine, but it looked like a bad air day in Cache Valley.
might have been.
That looks pretty good.
Let's see here.
That could be just a screen, too.
Yeah, I don't know. The rest of it's great.
I think they just screened at Jeannie, so
Todd, that lady looks familiar.
Pops out.
That's his wife.
I can explain that to you.
I see what you're talking about. So there's an editing effect that we put over. There's a blue filter on there. If you saw some of the display ads and things in the website, there's that blue filter that we've applied, kind of part of the brand look.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, if the board feels that that's a little bit of a concern, because it's the only place in the ad, everything else is not blue. So. Anyway, this has not launched yet. You guys are the first to see it. So, any other questions?
Anyone else? Any questions? No.
Really good presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. It's nice to see the numbers that are going up.
Yeah,
that's really cool.
It's great to do fun, creative things, but if we're not moving the needle, we need to reconsider, right? So
yes.
It's good to see that happening.
And we've used some of the presentation, right, already
mm-hmm.
at different schools, different cities.
we haven't been out to any cities yet, but we're using it in other things, and the cities are coming on in May. So.
Okay. Thank
right.
you very much.
Speaking
Sean.
Of moving the needle.
Yeah.
Well, speaking
Sean.
Of moving the needle.
Yes, Sean, would you move the needle?
This will be my last quarterly service report. Should I just stand at my little desk?
Or you can grab this microphone.
Though I spilled pizza on me, so I'm just sit like this. Okay. Oh, yeah, I'm going to sit down. Okay. It's right towards the back of the packet. You'll see a table like this and then a bunch of fun little line graphs. This is our quarterly service report. And, oh dear. So before we get into what they mean, I wanted you guys to look at the number of things that CVTD measures each month. If you look at the table, you'll see the year we compare 2019, which is at the bottom, with the last 2 years, 2018, 2017, for this quarter. And we have everything from total ridership to missed trips, bicycles loaded, vehicle miles, and then down at call a ride, there's two metrics we take for those. And so CVTD is very active in taking this data, and we have it stored forever. That's good to know. I mean, the bad news is, thus far, the marketing efforts haven't translated into increased ridership. In fact, we're still dropping. But hopefully there's kind of a delay in... It is my phone. Sorry. Hopefully there's a delay and it'll pick up and we'll turn around. So... Have we really?
Well, it sort of went up and down because it was like 39, then it was 339, then it was 210.
Yeah.
Can we take advantage?
The overall quarter, if you look, it's 454 to 443 to 534, so they've increased. Notice that the bicycles 2 years, so quarter compared to the last 2 years. So before we wig out about that. What is it?
Snowy.
That's right. We've had a wet spring.
Yeah.
The kids aren't out riding their bikes yet. So you kind of pick up on these things in this report. For example, we don't look at total ridership much because if a month happened to have more weekends than the other month where CBT doesn't run, and that's a difference of 50 to 100,000. And so ridership per revenue hour is the one that is normalized for that or standardized. Todd, what's the difference between missed trips and late trips?
So late trips is a requirement that we're so again, the National Transit Database is a central point that we all transit agencies across the country report their numbers to, and it's a way for us to do peer comparisons and things of that nature. The definition that they use is anything over 5 minutes late is a late trip from a scheduled destination. For us, where we're on this hub and spoke, that really didn't help us, right? So. I mean, we could be at the transit center 5 minutes late, and we miss transfers. Those people aren't making their connection. And so for us, we said we need to go beyond what the NTD is asking, and that's where we came up with missed trips or missed percentages of passengers, is because we actually want to know how are our riders impacted, not just – but we still are required to report the National Transit Database number. So.
Now, are you – is it the other way around? The transit database is missed trips, and you added in late trips?
No, late trips is the NTD, right, Mindy? Yeah, late trips is the NTD. Missed trips is we're talking about people missing their connection, missing their missed transfer trips. Yeah. Oh, let me look at this.
I'm sorry.
So there's two definitions for NTD. I'm sorry. So correct me if I'm wrong. Mindy's the NTD expert here. I'm going to put her on the spot. So late trips is over 5 minutes late. Missed trips is if we actually don't make a run, correct? And then missed transfers is what we are tracking is if we actually miss transfers. But missed trips is a low number, which is if we have a road call or snow routes can be that type of thing. If there's some reason, and then there's usually a notation as to why we've missed those trips.
And so these numbers are really quite good. CVTD's always been good. Very few missed trips, late trips. have really only been high historically when there's been construction or blizzards or something like that. I'm really impressed with it. I encourage you guys to kind of look at it and ponder what some of these things mean. And we hope that with rumor work, we'll see some ridership increasing. It'd be nice. Any questions about this report?
Do we have, you know, if there's any data that shows any correlation between gas prices and these numbers? Because now it's going to slide back up. I'm wondering if our...
Ridership's an important number, right? So we're always trying to determine that. There is some correlation between fuel prices. We see, when we really saw that before, it was like at $3.50 a gallon. But the other factor that we see is a big correlation is the unemployment rate. So when unemployment was at 4%, 4.5%, significant ridership growth. And we saw that back in 2008, 2009 with the, you know, recession. Unemployment we're seeing is probably almost a bigger factor than even fuel prices. But I think those two kind of correlate together.
Any other questions for Sean?
Can I ask a question for Sean and Jeff together? So, Jeff, how long do we give the marketing program to seed before maybe we start to say there's a connection point? I know the marketing has to kind of percolate for a while. But can you give us any kind of guidance on what kind of time frame we can expect before we could apply those to numbers like we're told right or better?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And the honest truth is I don't have an exact answer for you.
Yeah.
But, as you already mentioned and recognized, I think the whole year, and that's why I think the district committed to the full year. This isn't a quick shot in the arm. Hey, let's try this for a month or two and see if we see any kind of spike. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
We want to be able to look at year over year data, right? And having, I think, a full year of data, in this case, it's actually more like 9 months with the campaign. I think over that time, you know, that's a better period to see. And you've got to remember, too, I mean, people aren't necessarily going to see a TV ad here, radio, see it online. Oh, I've got to go get on the bus now, right? It's that repetition. It keep hitting them and with these reminders and these messages and different reasons to ride. And it's a behavioral change for a lot of people. We're trying to sway some of the occasional riders, those who've never ridden, to change a little bit of a behavior. So it is going to take some time. I think, you know, hopefully by mid-year we can maybe start to see an uptake. But certainly I think through the rest of the year we should have enough.
My understanding is also that the website's not just changing the user look and feel of it, but there's some functionality there as well, like efficient ride path. Is that occurring?
Mm-hmm.
And so that should make it more efficient as well.
Yeah, and that's another, maybe in the next board meeting I can go a little deeper on the website data. I mean, I showed you the effect the campaign is having on website visitors, right? But we could maybe dive into let's look at a website flow. Where are the visitors going when they get to the site? Which tools are they using? Mm-hmm. Are they using the, you know, next bus, or the plan my trip, the schedule? Yeah.
That'd be interesting.
And that we can know, I think, fairly soon. Within the next month or two, we'll see the beauty of the web. And that's the beauty of the web site and digital marketing. You get pretty quick feedback with the data.
Can I maybe add one thing to that, Patrick? Because I think what we're seeing is we're getting people engaged. But I think Patrick made this point, and I shared this with him earlier, and I think it's really valuable. And honestly, we talk about it a lot, is the global look. I mean, so marketing in and of itself is one aspect. But if we don't, and we're going to talk about this next month. I'm really excited to come talk to you next month and see what your take is on that. But we haven't made any significant route changes in over a decade. And, you know, we can market the heck out of things, but if we don't also say, what are the things we need to adjust and change to make it more efficient, to make it more usable. And I think to your point, Patrick, we did that with the website, but what are we doing to the service quality? And so I think that's the other piece of this that we want to bring to the table next month is here's some recommendations for what we think we need to do in conjunction with marketing, but also with how do we make it better for the consumer, and then how do we make it better for the person that's not even ever consumed it. And so I think it's a multiple phase thing, but great questions.
Nothing that hasn't already been said. Unemployment, gas prices, convenience culture, you know, and so marketing will address some of those. Service changes will address some of those. I'm actually quite excited for the next meeting. The last time we made some service changes, it had a tremendous impact on kind of really rider, not just ridership, but connectivity. So, yeah, you guys want to be here next month.
Okay. Any other questions?
Okay. Okay, so Heidi, can we, is it okay if we do a motion?
Yeah, Ron, do you want to make a motion?
The service report is actually, it lends itself to supporting the, I guess I'm getting competition here. It lends itself to supporting the ENDS policies that we've, developed. And so I would propose that a motion that we have the service report given to the board by Todd's group on a quarterly basis. That way we know what's happening, know what's going on, and it fits right into our ENDS policy, which is basically who we are and what we're doing and how we're benefiting the community. Okay. That's my motion.
Okay, can I get a second?
I second whatever Ron said.
All right, thank you, John. Okay. Well, look outside and
just destroying our car.
Right, that's what I'm thinking.
It's too late now.
Oh, it's over. Okay. All right. Okay. Does anyone have any things, any questions or concerns about this motion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. All right. We'll move on to the Trust Accountability Award with Jason Watterson. Did you have an intro?
Sure. Okay.
So this is Jason Watterson from the Utah Local Governments Trust. They're the entity that provides us with our insurance. And Jason's a local boy. He's from here in Benson. He's father of five.
Yeah.
Father of five. Great guy. And again, we've told you before, Jason's the guy that come and does our unannounced audits. And I think he's a recovering OSHA guy, right? You used to do OSHA audits, or
I didn't work for OSHA, but I've worked in industry. Okay. Keeping people out of trouble.
Well, I will tell you, he's a super nice guy. I mean, a guy you want to go hang out with, but he is a very strict when it comes to safety compliance, and we appreciate that. He keeps us on our game, and so we appreciate him being here.
Todd, thank you very much. Board, appreciate the opportunity to come in and present the Trust Accountability Program Award again. This is, I believe, the fourth consecutive year, and that's not just a small thing. It's a pretty major accomplishment. In the trust, we have over 550 local governments around the state, and it's about a fifth of them will actually get the TAP program, because it takes some work. And you say, what's the TAP program? Just in brief, I don't want to belabor take your time on this. But what we did is several years ago, we said, what are the things that any organization needs to have in place to have a good safety and risk management program? And we challenged our members around the state to do that. And we threw out some carrots as well. I'm supposed to look at that, Todd, ahead of time, and see what the number was. You guys have already received a check. We give you a percentage of your liability premium back. I was supposed to look at that. Let's see, $4,171.15, a nice check. It's a good chunk of your liability premium that we give you back, and we give you big discounts on your workers' compensation premium, because that money sounds, you know, $4,000. Anybody take that? But that pales in comparison to the big money, which is preventing accidents. You've got a fleet of giant vehicles running through our communities, going back and forth, and a whole bunch of people working there. With that comes a lot of risk. And our goal with the TAP program was to help develop cultures of safety throughout our members in the state. And I'm pleased to say, CBTD has always had that culture, and they don't rest on their laurels. As we go along, we say, you know, Todd's team does an awesome job. They work really hard, but they don't sit back and say, you know what, we're doing good. You know, we haven't had an accident for X amount of time. We're doing good. They're always looking at that, and we've had this conversation multiple times of, you can't just sit back on a safety program. You've got to be looking ahead, and they're really one of the most proactive teams that I see among 550 plus local governments around the state. So really want to give them kudos for their work and for all of the time that they put in. It takes a lot of time, effort, and money to have a good safety program, and they've worked really hard to do that. They're committing time, supervisors' times, to sit down with drivers and review the good and the bad, and doing just some really innovative stuff that I really think is some of the best things. I've got over 20 years in the industry. These are some of the best things that I've ever seen in my career. And so you should be proud of your district and proud of the team that you've got there. So congratulations on getting the TAP award, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Jason. Does anyone have any questions for Jason?
Just real quick, I'd just like to say that really is the team, and you got a good majority of them here. But yeah, definitely. These guys are the ones that innovate. I wish I could take part, but I get to listen and to their wisdom. But these guys really push the needle all the time. It's really cool. But thanks, Jason.
Thank you. Okay, we'll move to number 8, Cache Valley Air Quality, and Dr. Randy Martin.
I'll do a little introduction. So Randy has the unfortunate or fortunate, whichever you want to look at. He was my neighbor for, I don't know, how long were we neighbors for, Randy?
17 years,
yeah. So Randy's just a great guy, and I would say the foremost expert in air quality in the Valley. He's been dealing with this issue for us for such a long time and helping get education out and helping understand the real science behind what is our air quality issue. And I thought it would be really good for Randy to come and kind of educate us about what are the issues and maybe kind of talk about some opportunities we have in the future to understand the impact we can have on the community. And so with that, we'll turn it over to Randy.
All right, well, thanks, Todd, for inviting me here. Some of you have spoken in front of me before, some of you have not. I am a professor up at Utah State, Civil Environmental Engineering Department, my appointment at the Utah Water Research Lab. The Water Research Lab is kind of where we do all the research, whereas on campus is obviously the academic side of things. I am also a member of the State of Utah Air Quality Board, so I'm touching my toes into the policy world, and that's as much as to politics as I ever want to go. But if you need to contact me for any reason, please feel free to email me at my USU address or call me on my campus phone. I'll be happy to get back to you as soon as I can. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about air quality generally here in the Cache Valley, just to make sure we're all on the same page. And then I'll tell you about some of the work we've done with mobile source emissions, which gets to you all. So first thing I wanted to point out is the state of the air. And this is a report that's annually put out by the American Lung Association. And fortunately or unfortunately, the new report literally just came out today. So you've all seen these numbers before. They list who's got the best and worst air pollution in the country. And these are all based on the regulatory monitoring sites all around the country. And so when the first report came back out in 2004, actually it's not the first report. The first report came out in 20 years ago. But this is kind of the latest one that we started really paying attention to, but we started bumping up in the list. And 8 on the list, and at dealing with 24-hour PM2.5, we also keep track of annual PM2.5 and annual ozone. This is what we made the list for. Back then, we were number 8. 2015 report, which was the 2012-2014 data, we jumped up to number 7. And the march just continues, number 8 in the 16 report, number 11 in the 2017 report, and this report that just came out, we were number 11 once again. Like everywhere else, our air pollution has gotten a little better over the years, but it's not gone away. And just as information, this is the first year that Salt Lake has been on the list for ozone pollution. I'm a little surprised, to tell you the truth, that the Uinta Basin's not on this list either. Probably has something to do with how many people they have out there, but they do have bad ozone out in the Uinta Basin in the wintertime instead of the summertime, which is unique. Only one other place in the world has high wintertime ozone. That's the Pine Dale area in Wyoming. You can connect the dots. It's similar between those two. I'll tell you about it later. Because we're number 7, 8, 11 on this list, doesn't mean that we still don't have the worst air in the nation on certain days. We actually had the worst air in the nation at least twice this last winter because of our inversions and the levels that we get. This gives you an idea of our regulatory timeline to show you that our pollution, our pollution is seemingly getting somewhat better if you take it back to about the year 2001, which is when PM2.5 was starting being measured here in the Cache Valley. And the red line represents the 24-hour regulatory values. The blue line represents the annual average regulatory values. And then the dotted line represents the 3-year running average. And it's those 3-year running averages that we're actually regulated under. So the black dotted line represents the national standard. You can see the national 24-hour standard changed back in 2006-2007. The annual standard changed in 2012-2013. And I will pause just a second to say, when this happened, there were some area politicians, state and local, that said, oh, they lowered the standard on us. And that's wrong. They lowered the standard for us. Because when the standard was first put in place, it was based on the data at that time. There have been many, many, many studies come out that show that standard was not nearly protective enough. And there's lots of studies coming out there showing that standard is not nearly protective enough. Every year there's a plethora of new studies that come out that relate PM2.5, ozone, NOx, to new and very significant health impacts, including things like low birth weights, autism, breast cancer, heart attacks, of course, on and on and on. The data are just irrefutable that these do have health impacts. But the good news is that our pollution is generally getting lower and we have a decreasing trend. The Cache Valley was first promulgated as being non-attainment back in 2009, and that meant that we had to write a plan to reach attainment. And originally that plan was submitted in 2014, and we were supposed to reach attainment by 2014. That was extended actually to 2017. Kind of thanks to the Idaho DEQ, they pushed it and said we maybe didn't have enough data. So 2017 became our official target attainment date. If you look at that little dot right there on the dotted line, we literally just made it. Our average, I think, was 34.4. It has to be below 35. So we literally just made it. So we did what they call demonstrated attainment. That doesn't mean we're out of the woods. We have to demonstrate attainment for 20 years. So you can see that our trend is still decreasing, but 2019, as of February, we had 4 exceedances. We're basically allowed 6. So December has to be really good to us this year in order for us not to exceed and go back the other way. And if you look at that in another form, the number of red and yellow days has shown a generally decreasing but wildly varying trend. 2017, we had, I think it was 67 yellow days right there. And those are the days we really need to pay attention to. We're impacting our health. We're starting to move towards the exceedance days, but we're not quite there yet. So that's when we really need to be conscious of what we're putting into our air. And then, like I say, 2019, the data are still being analyzed, but the trend is in the right direction. What do we attribute that to? I think one of the biggest things is the inspection and maintenance program that we put on our vehicles. We knew before that program went in place that roughly 5 to 10% of our vehicles would fail. And Lloyd, maybe you can tell me, Josh Weaver here, who can tell us the exact numbers, but I think it was 8 to 12% of our vehicles failed. And by identifying those, getting them to clean up or being taken off the road, we got a huge increase, or decrease, I should say, in the pollution emissions. So I think that had a long ways to go. Plus the national vehicle fleet turnover, including the mass transit system, the newer buses are much, much cleaner than the older buses. And so all that helps, and is going towards that decrease. Not to mention the fact that we've all lived in the valley for quite a while here. We just haven't had the winters that we had back in the early 2000s. We've had a lot more mild winter. This winter, great example. We did have a few exceedances, but it was a storm every 3 or 4 days. You know, it just kind of kept sweeping the valley out. We didn't allow that month-long time like we did back in 2004, where we had the whole month of January inverted. So weather's helped us out as well. A little bit about what our air pollution is, Cache Valley Air Pollution 101. And we need to look at what our particles are made up of. And in general, particles are made up of 5 broad compound classes, chemical classes. The first being crustal, soil elements, dust, dirt. Road dust, wind erosion, rock crushing. As you can guess, in the wintertime when we have air pollution issues, that's probably not going to be a huge issue because the ground's covered with snow. You can also have what's called light-absorbing carbon or black carbon. This is what you typically think of as soot. And that comes from wood stoves and diesel fuels primarily. You can also have what's called organic carbon. So this is unburned fuels, condensed organic material, evaporative emissions. In the summertime, there could be biogenic emissions, stuff emitted from plants. Again, that's not going to be a real issue in the wintertime down here. Then you get what's called ammonium sulfate. This is a particle or a component of the particulate matter that is formed from oxides of sulfur, which are typically emitted from coal combustion or diesel fuel, as well as smelting, and then ammonia. You have ammonia in the atmosphere. And it's no surprise around here we have ammonia in our atmosphere. And just to give away a little of the secret, we actually have the highest ammonia concentrations in the country right here in Cache Valley. And not high by a little bit. High by an order of 3 to 5. Not, I should say order by a factor of 3 to 5. It's not that we emit any more ammonia, but we trap it, just like we trap our inversions in the wintertime. We trap it all around in our valley. And then you can have ammonium nitrate, which, just like ammonium sulfate, is formed from gaseous compounds, ammonia being one of them, and then oxides of nitrogen, which come from any time you combust anything. Bringing oxygen into your combustion chamber, it's got a lot of nitrogen with it, and so that forms oxides of nitrogen. And I would assume that a lot of you are probably already aware, if you look at the pie slices of what our particulate compounds are made out of here in the Cache Valley, by far the biggest slices are nitrates and ammonia. So ammonium nitrates, on average, if you just take average, make up over 75% of our particulate mass. If you look on it on a bad day, a red air day, it can make up to 90% of our particulate mass. So if we want to control particulate in the Cache Valley, we have to control ammonium nitrate. So what is the chemistry of ammonium nitrate? This is the slide I typically show everybody, and it tries to simplify a very complex set of equations. Basically, we have ammonia, which in Cache Valley, literally 95-98% of our ammonia comes from the ag industry. Okay, that's where we live. We have on the order of 100,000 cows in the valley. There's like 3.5 million chickens. There's 20,000 hogs, and about 6,000 horses. And one of the things I learned in doing all this, Cache County is the 3rd largest mink producer in the country. You know what the second largest meat producer in the country is? Franklin County.
Yeah,
but combined, those two don't produce as much mink as some county in Wisconsin. So, you know, even combined, we're number two and three, but we're not high as number one. Why is mink important? How many of you guys smell the mink? You know, gone by a mink farm. They produce amine compound. Ammonia is one of them. So we got an abundance of ammonia just because of where we live. The other half of that equation, the nitrate side, is actually nitric acid as a gas. And that comes from oxides of nitrogen, which are formed from any combustion product or any combustion process. And I just show cars here. But any combustion process, your home heaters produce it. Any combustion process. And then also hydrocarbons, which come from, again, cars, but also lots of area sources. Your local McDonald's produces hydrocarbons. Paint shops, cabinet makers, dry cleaners, they all produce hydrocarbons. Those are what we call area sources. But all those hydrocarbons on oxides of nitrogen go through a series of chemical reactions in the atmosphere and end up with nitric acid. So our first question we asked ourselves back in 2006 or so was, which one of those is more important? Which one is the limiting reagent? Which one should we go after? And again, it's not a surprise, we're ammonia rich in the Cache Valley by a factor of somewhere between 2 and 6. So we would have to get rid of at least half of the ammonia before we would even start to see a change in our ammonium nitrate. So that's just economically not feasible to do in the valley. So we want to go after the nitrate side, which means going after oxide nitrogen or hydrocarbons. It means understanding this chemistry, because now which one do you go after? The hydrocarbons or the NOx or both of them? So we have to understand all that. We have to understand what type of hydrocarbons are there. So as you can guess, we've done lots and lots of studies. GAQ has done lots of studies. We even had people from BYU and the University of Utah who are helping us on trying to understand that. What it comes down to is understanding where all this comes from. And if you look at where the emissions, the primary emissions of carbon monoxide, oxide of nitrogen, PM2.5, for us, the ammonium nitrate, like I say, is formed in the atmosphere. But there are some small sources of direct PM2.5. Diesel vehicles, for example. Oxide of sulfur, and then the hydrocarbons are VOCs. VOCs is just another shorthand for hydrocarbons. That stands for volatile organic compounds, but it's the same thing. So if you look at that pie chart, this is Cache Valley, our annual emission inventory. So we emit 19,702 tons of pollutants into our atmosphere every year. And of that, the big thing I want to point out is almost 50% of it comes from on-road mobile sources. So that's our cars, our buses, our trucks. About a little over a quarter of it comes from non-road mobile sources. Those would be trains. More importantly, farm equipment. That's a big part of that. And then smaller bits from area sources, just here, and just a little tiny bit of what we call point sources. Point sources are smokestacks, large industry. We just don't have those in the Cache Valley. Matter of fact, there is one permitted point source in the Cache Valley. Anybody know what it is? I'm looking at Ron. Do you know what it is? It's Pepperidge Farms. They have a permit for hydrocarbons. Except those are alcohol-based hydrocarbons, so they don't really contribute to our photochemistry. So they're not a problem. More specifically, we really want to look at the NOx and the hydrocarbon, because that's what our problem are. So where do those come from? Whoops, no, I want to show you this skirt. This is the Wasatch Front. Very similar down there. About half from mobile sources, both on-road and off-road. More point sources, but there's more large industry down there, right? Kennecott, refineries, on and on. But even that, they're only responsible for 13% of the pollution down there. And they're pretty well controlled, to tell you the truth. So down there, they do need to go after mobile sources as well as area sources. But getting back to our primary VOC and NOx emissions, which is what we have to target here in the Cache Valley. If you look at the VOCs, area sources make up just a little bit under 50% of the VOCs. So the McDonald's, the cabinet makers, the dry cleaners, the print shops, the paint shops, they're still responsible for a large part of the VOCs. But mobile sources are the other half. and it's roughly equally split between non-road and on-road. Again, point sources is almost nothing. If you look at Knox, that's where the on-road really jumps up. So if we want to control Knox, we have to control on-road sources, our cars, our buses. So there's just no doubt that mobile sources are a huge part of the picture.
Rick, has there been a, have we tracked the mobile sources over very many years, like this?
This is from the 2014 emissions inventory. The 2017 is out, and then there was a 2011 or 2007. So it's been tracked.
So did we go, look, what I'm looking at is, have we seen a decrease at all in our mobile sources?
No, not really, not in the percentage. But what we have seen is a decrease in the size of the pie overall. So the emissions are decreasing kind of overall.
So whatever we're doing on the mobile sources, there must be an equal amount of effort in the other areas.
In the area sources in particular, yeah, that's coming down. And a lot of that is really new vehicle fleet technology, whereas area sources are more like using low volatility solvents. Almost all the paint shops around here have gone to those. There were supposed to, maybe you guys, I mean, you can help tell me, there were supposed to be some installation of pollution control equipment on things like open grills and vapor recovery systems on car painting facilities. I don't know how much of those have been implemented, but supposedly they have been. So that has shrunk the pie. And the parts and pieces, the slices may have changed a little bit, but not significantly. On-road mobile sources are still our number one NOx, and then the VOCs are still dominated by area sources. But you could also make the argument that VOCs are dominated by both non-road and on-road mobile sources, too.
Besides the emissions, we've had a vehicle replacement program that's gone on the last 2 or 3 years, and I wish there was a way to measure that, the effectiveness of that, compared to everything else that we're doing, but I don't know if there really is.
There would be ways to model it, but not really quantify it, you know, on the ground. We should know what year and model cars were replaced with, but we don't know what their emissions were.
We've had a pretty significant impact on that area.
Yeah, if you remember back in 2004 when we did the on-road mobile studies, I mean, we found that literally, I'm going to see if I get these numbers right, 4% of the cars were what we call gross emitters for NOx, and they were responsible for 25% of all the vehicle emissions, the 4%, and 10% of the cars gross emitters for hydrocarbons, and they were responsible for 50% of all vehicle hydrocarbons. So by identifying or replacing those bad actors, you get a huge benefit. And that's, I mean, that's why I was pushing for IM programs since 2004, is that initial improvement.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
So mobile sources, very important, of which the bus fleet is part of the mobile sources, obviously. So we've done lots of studies at the USU and continue to do lots of studies. First one was a laser-based on-road study where we shot lasers across the road and measured every single car that rode on 400 North or out on Valley View Highway or over by Smithfield. We moved it all around for a week, and that's where we got all those great measurements. In 2007-2011, we did on-road tailpipe bus emission studies. And then we compared those to a sampling of local automobiles. We did what we called the Cold Start Hot Start idling study, where we measured 70 vehicles that were typical of the Cache Valley vehicle fleet, and we let them sit for 24 hours in the wintertime, and then started them up and looked up to see what their pollution was when we started them up, how long it took for it to level off. We compared that to what's called a hot start, so you drive it around, you run to this grocery store, shut it off, and then restart it. What do the emissions look like after 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes? And we compared that to idling a car for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes to see, should I shut my car off when I go into 7-Eleven and get a Big Gulp, or should I let it sit there and idle? Obviously, you shouldn't let it sit and idle. We had data to prove it. 2016, we did a really cool study, a driver characteristic study, where we looked to see who had the lowest emissions of a set of drivers driving the same car over the same route between what we called experienced males and experienced females, meaning they had greater than 10 years of driving experience, and then inexperienced males and females, meaning they have less than 5 years driving experience. Who do you think was the cleanest drivers? Those four groups.
Probably the inexperienced drivers.
Inexperienced female drivers by far had the lowest and most consistent emissions. And we're actually trying to get a paper published on that right now. And one of the comments was, well, there are two comments, they're kind of saying, first of all, we used a 2001 Durango simply because I had that vehicle. But one of the reviewer's comments was, well, that's an atypical vehicle. People aren't familiar with driving pickup SUV style vehicles. So I looked it up. You know what the percentage of pickups and SUV vehicles are here? 47% of the vehicles on them. So I counterbacked the rumor, no, this is a typical vehicle. And all the drivers said, yeah, we drive pickups all the time. So the other comment was they didn't think the young female group was a representative driver group because they'd be timid. How many of you have driven with a young female driver? Not timid at all, so I had to put it in political terms to come on as common. I have her back in my niece. 2017, we did a really cool study in a lab class I teach where we looked at the pollution in your car compared to the outside pollution. It's the same. It doesn't change. I mean, if it did, you'd be suffocating yourself in your car, right? Because you'd be using up all the oxygen and building up CO2. So, no, you need that. This year, just last week, I did another lab experiment with how we made on-road tailpipe emissions of a bunch of student cars. And I'll show you that. That's kind of interesting. And then we're starting a brand new study where we're looking at gasoline and diesel dynamometer on-road studies looking at tailpipe emissions. We're going to focus on ammonia. Because we think ammonia from mobile sources could be sort of one of the big unaccounted for emission budgets, particularly down the Wasatch Front. They've got a lot of ammonia down there. We just don't know where it comes from. So that we think this is probably a big part of it. And this could really lead into I'm going to quickly show you these two studies. I'm going to start with the student tailpipe study we did last week. So this is the way we do the study. We put a probe in the tailpipe of the car. That probe has an umbilical, comes in this black umbilical, and goes into our little monitor box here where we measure for CO, CO2, hydrocarbons, NOx, and oxygen. And then this little clear tube here, since this is in your car, you don't want the exhaust building up in your car, so we bring that back up the window so nobody passes out. And this graph is kind of hard to see. But this is the four vehicles that we measured. The top one was a 95 Oldsmobile. The next one was the Subaru Outback 2012, and the 2002 Lexus, and then the 2002 Nissan Xterra. All driving the same route, which is from the water lab up the Dugway, then up 400, and down 400 back to the water lab. And so what you see here are the NOx and the hydrocarbons. I just want to point out, when you see big spikes, the blue is the NOx. That's essentially going up either the Dugway or the hill on 400. NOx is a strong function of how much low your engine is on. So when you're accelerating, going up a hill, making the engine work, your NOx emissions go up. Whereas hydrocarbons are typically a function of times when your engine is running rich. So when you kind of just either just pull back or just accelerate, got a lot of excess fuel in the combustion chamber, so the hydrocarbons go up. Same with CO, which I'm not showing here. But what I want to show you is just in these different vehicles, the different behaviors of all the pollutants, and including the Xterra, it was just high all the time. We couldn't quite figure out what was going on with it. And it was high for both NOx and hydrocarbons, which is somewhat unusual that it's either burning rich or burning one thing or the other, because it's either burning rich or burning lean. That was just all over the place. And he would not pass an emissions inspection, actually. They did a tailpipe study. His were all high. The Subaru Outback, I don't show you this, although got some weird things going on with the hydrocarbons here. It was also excessive in its carbon monoxide. It would not pass a carbon monoxide inspection.
We should all be driving a Lexus.
We should be driving a Lexus. it's good admission. And then this is, if you look at it, you know, you've got copies of this here. This is the gram This graph is all in concentration units, parts per million. In order to compare with standards, you have to convert that to grams per mile, which means you have to know what the flow rate through the tailpipe is. And we've got ways to measure that too, and I'm sure that's here. But again, huge variability. Note that this is a logarithmic axis, so orders of 10 difference in magnitude, with the highest emissions by far being carbon dioxide. But that's really what you want. You want to convert all your fuel to carbon dioxide and water, so you're using up all the energy. And those numbers all happen to be within the greenhouse gas guidelines of around 300 to 500 grams per mile. And then the yellow bar charts are all the Xterra. You can see that's all high. Also, the Subaru is high for CO. So that's the kind of stuff we can do, and that's what I would kind of propose that we do with you guys. The bus studies, again, on-road real-time tailpipe measurements. And the question we wanted to ask ourselves basically was, how many people would we have to convince to park the car and get on the bus in order to see a net decrease in the area emissions? And so, again, we put the probe in the tailpipe. One of the things we learned on this first study we did was diesel bus exhaust is really, really hot. And we actually melted our umbilical. So we had to figure out, we just added on a little temperature dissipator. And then we rode the bus. Literally, it was me and a couple of students would ride around in the bus, making the measurements as we went on the buses. We rode different routes. And this was the results of the 2007 study. And so what these numbers represent, for each of the pollutants, how many people you'd have to convince to get on the bus and park the car. And so it was only for hydrocarbons and for the diesel bus where one driver would make a difference. For NOx, 21 drivers would have to ride. 77 for CO before you'd see a decrease in the net emissions. Compressed natural gas, one of the Agni shuttles, really high NOx emissions, but that's kind of expected, hydrocarbons, but they're real clean for CO, and that's what natural gas buses get you, to decrease the CO emissions. So, yeah, great, we saw that. Todd gave us the opportunity to repeat this study in 2011. I just had a really motivated student who wanted to do this, and at that time, bus technologies had changed over enough that people had decreased overall, and you see a decrease in overall area emissions. So that was great. So I had lunch with Todd the other day, and he was talking about, well, maybe we need to look at the studies again, see what we're adding to the airship. So Todd proposed a couple things, and I rewrote them a little bit, Todd.
Please.
Again, it'd be good to measure the specific levels of the pollutants coming out of the bus fleets. Primarily, we want to look at NOx and VOCs. But while we're there, we can also do CO and CO2, maybe direct particulate matter. One of the things we found in a little study we did several years ago was, particularly when the buses go through a regen cycle, particulate concentrations go through the roof. And they go through such high enough that it really is questionable whether you're getting a benefit off the diesel particle filters. There's such a high, huge puff of dirt that comes out of there. That'd be interesting to look at, and I would propose that if we were to do further studies, would piggyback on the study that I've got going with the folks down at Weber to look at ammonia as well. It would kind of be a look at different routes, city routes versus high-speed longer routes like the route to Preston. Does the emissions change as you get up to higher sustained speeds, or does it level off? What are the effect of different buses on the same route? What are the effect of different drivers on the same route? Are there differences of time of day? Time of day of week? All those things can affect emissions. Obviously, we'd want to compare with the earlier studies. And we would like to compare with average Cache Valley passenger vehicles. But what does that mean? Are we all going to use the 2002 vehicles of the students? Or do we take Todd's car, my car, everybody else's car, see what those are? How many do you have to do to be representative? It would also be very interesting to do a cold start, hot start, idling emission study. What do your emissions look like when you start the buses up in the morning? how long is it going to go high? And that red little chart there, that's our cold emission study. So what you see, this is one for hydrocarbons, but you start a car up and the emissions go up very quick, then it drops off. In 1 to 3 minutes, it drops off. And what that tells you is, if your car is newer than 96, you do not need to warm up your car at all. Start it and go. And then a mechanic will tell you the same thing. Your car mechanically does not need to be warmed up. And as a matter of fact, if you start it and go, this 1 to 2 minute spike will actually decrease down to about 30 seconds, because the faster you heat up your catalytic converter, the more efficient it becomes. And then this study, this chart here, shows you the results of our hot start versus idle. So if you shut your car off for 5 minutes and then start it, you get this little magenta colored bar chart as far as emissions. If you let it idle for 5 minutes, you get this orange emission. So you emit quite a bit more idling than you do starting it off, in as little as 5 minutes. 10 minutes, the idling goes up even more. 20 minutes, it goes up even more. After 20 minutes, you're starting to cool the catalytic converter off a little bit, so your hot start does emit a little more, but nowhere close to idling for 20 minutes. So idling, if you don't have to, at least in your car. How's that going to apply to buses? Obviously, when you pull up to a bus stop, you can't shut the bus off. But what about when you come back to transit station, if you're there for a half hour, 20 minutes, 15 minutes? What's that magic time window? Don't know.
Is the hot start actually lower at 10 minutes than 5 minutes, according to your study?
Just barely, yeah. And
it's kind of weird.
It's an average set of data, so average over 70 cars. Statistically, it's not different. But yeah, that is slightly lower. These are all things that we could do. I haven't figured out how much it would cost, somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000. But there was also, just literally today, I got an email about this program. It's called ERCO, Undergraduate Research something, where the school will actually help fund some labor undergraduates, as long as we've got money that we can kick in to help offset that. So that's something, and the ERCO grants are due June 15th. So we've got a little time. The only problem is I have to identify undergraduates who now will want to work in the fall on this. And if you get the most PR bang for the buck, we would want to get it going this fall, so you have something to talk about in January when the pollution is bad. Say, look, here's what we're doing. Assuming things turn out favorably. So with that, thank you for letting me be here. And be happy to answer your questions.
Are there any questions?
I got one. You know, I've worked at a place where we spend bigger dollars than you've got, because I work for the Department of Energy. And we always seem to be able to be really, really good at detecting what's in the atmosphere, more so than we are on how to clean it up.
Well, with air pollution, unlike some other things, it's not really a matter of cleaning up the air. Preventing it from getting dirty in the first place.
Okay, well, you know, there's a lot of things. I mean, every time I've heard a lot of, I've had lots of discussions with friends, you know, they always say, well, you know, you need to go out and get a hybrid, you need an electric car, you need to get this, you need to get that, and I go, great, who's going to spend $80,000 on a new car? You know, I know there's a bazillion reasons why we should do this, should be more environmentally, but every time I hear these studies, they're great, they're wonderful, but what are we doing to help industry clean itself up? I mean, if I buy my truck that I bought, that I have now, is California emissions, which are great, you know.
What year is it?
2006.
Okay.
You know, and so I figure I'm at least a step ahead.
Okay, I can answer that. And Lloyd kind of pointed to some of it too. There are, for extreme gross emitters and people that are economically disadvantaged, there are programs to help you replace or fix your vehicle. If you guys heard about tier three fuels and tier three vehicles, it's yet another manufactured requirements to have cleaner vehicles. But also as part of that, the tier three fuels are cleaner fuels, and by have less sulfur in them. is they have less sulfur in them. That's the biggest thing. And the reason why that's important, even if you have an old vehicle, your catalytic converter gets what they call poisoned by sulfur. Sulfur attaches itself to the active sites on your catalytic converter, and then your catalytic converter is not going to work as efficiently as it could. So even an older vehicle with these new Tier 3 fuels is going to have lower emissions. Now, one of the sort of problems the way that that program implemented is it's implemented nationwide. And so a refinery can choose to say, well, we're going to phase this in, but we're going to do it at our largest refineries down in Houston, and we're not going to care about the refineries here on the Wasatch Front because they're smaller. It's going to cost us more. But that being said, the Utah legislature and the governor built in some tax incentives to help them encourage them. And three of the four refineries have decided to start producing Tier 3 fuels. There's only one, it's the smaller of the four, is not on board with doing that yet. And so even an old vehicle is going to start, like the wood stove change programs, like the wood stove change. And now wood stoves are not a huge part of our problem here in Cache Valley, but they are a visible part of our problem. And so that little bit of changing those out is more, in my mind, public awareness. It gets people thinking, okay, I'm helping out, what else can I do? Do I carpool? Do I trip change? Do I drive my cleanest, newest vehicle? It could be like Ed Redd, do I ride my bike year round? You know, with these new e-bikes, I actually rode an e-bike for the first time yesterday, and I was amazed. I might get one of those, start riding that in.
Well, I know, like in California, you can only buy gas in California that's manufactured in California. So you got two refineries in Southern California and up in Richmond, and you can only buy gas that is. That's why when I was living there, we were always paying more.
You're paying more for other reasons there too.
I know California loves to. Jerry Brown just imposed a 20-cent gas tax on it. But the fact is that they would switch. You would go to the gas station, and they would say, "Okay, it was like a summer gas."
Yeah. Well, we did that here too. We have summer gas, winter gas. Your truck's 2006. Mine's 2007. But I will guarantee you, my truck is the most well-tested vehicle in the valley. I will be loaning it to the people down at Weber State here very shortly, and they're going to run in a series of new catalytic converters through it to see which one's the best. And that is one something that everybody can do too. Your catalytic converter, particularly yours and mine, were designed to run to operate 75,000 to 80,000 miles. I've got 207,000 miles on my truck right now.
I got 186.
Yeah, but you can buy a new catalytic converter for between $200 and $1,200, and your emissions will drop like a rock. I don't mean this insultingly, but I guarantee you your car is emitting like it did in 2006.
Well, I'm sure it has. It's got older.
Sure, yeah. And the emission limits allow for that as well. So there are things everybody can do. It's a matter of what we need to do. And the biggest thing, I say this every time I give a talk, is realize that we're all part of this problem. And we've all just got to do a little bit. It's not a lot. When we wrote our SIP, State Implementation Plan, we had to reduce our valley-wide emissions by 5.7 tons per day. And it's 5.7%. I can't remember what the actual number is. I think it was 1.7 or 1.8 tons per day. 5.7%, so that's really nothing. That's taking one less trip. How many miles do you think we drive here in Cache Valley? How many miles are put on the road in Cache Valley in a day? 2.8 million. That's nuts.
For you, especially when the road is only 100 miles long.
Yeah, I know. The average number is, we drive our car average, and this I can't believe either, 27 miles a day. With 11 starts and stops. That should be easy to everybody to say, I'm going to do 10 starts and stops. I'm going to drive 25 miles instead of 27. There's on the order of a huge increase. There's on the order of about 90,000 registered vehicles in Cache County. We should be able to just do those little things.
Have they ever thought about doing a study to see if they could change the inversion layer?
Yeah. About every 5 years, I assign that problem to my students in my engineering class. And just let them think out of the box, what can we do? And things have been like boreholes in the Wellsville Mountains.
Big fans.
Try to get heat transfer between the top of the Bear River Range here and then down here. One of the more creative ones I thought was putting out heating plates all around the valley to actually heat the ground so it causes convective uplift. And what they decided they needed as far as energy was the size of the nuclear power plant Palo Verde's down in Arizona. Run that for, you know, 3 weeks a year. So that's how much energy would take you to create the inversion.
Well, they did when I was in college, our professor was talking about the same subject, and they were saying that if they raised the inversion layer in L.A., that by 3 feet they could create a tropical environment like is in Hawaii. And they said the only problem was that they figured it out. At that time, their study showed that it would take the energy of a nuclear explosion.
Yeah.
And one of the students goes, so what's the problem?
I might have this number wrong. I don't have the order of magnitude wrong, though. But I think when we have inverted air, we have 13 trillion cubic feet of air that we have to move. And you have to do that in one day, or however fast you want to get rid of the inversion. It's not practical, but it's a fun engineering calculation to do. Theoretically, it's possible.
Any other questions?
No.
I think the Tier 3 gas is going to be a significant issue.
I agree. I think it will help. Mm-hmm. And every year, our vehicle fleet gets a little more modern, and that helps us out. When we first started doing these studies, I think it was like 45% of the cars were 96 or 95 and older. And now it's like 5 or 6%.
Are we doing anything to address the agricultural vehicle segment of the population?
No. I say no. If you have a diesel vehicle that's 90 or 2007 and newer, you can now do computer checks on the engines where you can't do it before.
But the new diesel tractors have been significant.
They're better, yeah. The new vehicles are better. But
I thought you didn't have to do emissions on any agriculture.
Even an agricultural pickup, if they want to declare it as an agricultural vehicle, it gets a waiver.
It's just the manufacturers are doing it for.
Yeah, the manufacturers are doing it for. And, you know, when I hear people say things like these laws and regulations are bad, no, they're not. You know, that's really what's forcing us to have better, cleaner vehicles. I was in a meeting a couple weeks ago with some of the state legislatures, and a few of them said, well, I prefer to let the people take responsibility and do it on their own, and it's not going to happen.
Right.
You look at history, and it has never happened. That's why we had, in 1970, the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, EPA form.
So
and the vehicle mileage, the CAFE standards.
What happens to all the, I mean, we have a tremendous amount, in my opinion, of semi-traffic.
We do.
Do we have any way, or is there any regulation that exists on those vehicles?
On a national basis, yes. I know a long time ago we did look at that in Cache County. What can we do to those vehicles coming in? There's not much. It's interstate traffic or transport. So we have to kind of rely on federal guidelines.
Yeah, they do a lot of stops and starts.
Yeah, they do. And I know Miller's, well, it's not Miller's now anymore, are they?
JBS.
They have gone to a lot more plug-in, and even that new, well, it was going to be new, that we're going to put that truck stop down the south end of the valley, they were looking at all electric plug-ins rather than letting the truck sit there and run. And even the trains that sit here in Iowa, I don't think they do that anymore in the valley. So there are some recognition of that.
Okay.
Matter of fact, a student told me that, one of the students in my lab class, her brother had a car that would not pass an emissions inspection program here in the valley. So what do you do with it?
We'll die out.
Yeah, exactly. You register in front of them.
Yeah.
So that happens.
I heard some guy talking about how great that was.
Yeah. Well, and like on campus for several years now, in order to get a parking pass, the students are supposed to show that they're from a county that has an IM program, or they have to go down and get a Cache County IM program. But I know for a fact, several students have just waived that. They tell them down there, yeah, I've got it, to get their parking pass. Supposedly it's computerized and you can check on the thing. They don't.
Okay, anything else? It's been a great discussion. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Randy.
Thank you, Randy.
Oh, that's great. Okay, number 9, consideration of Title VI program.
I have to excuse Curtis. He actually had a commitment tonight. But so on, starting on page 5 of your packet is the Title VI program. Every 3 years, we're required by the FTA to bring this before you. So boards in the past have received this, reviewed this. So essentially what the Title VI program does is it verifies that we're not discriminatory in the way in which we're planning and delivering service. So the challenge is that there may be times where, you know, a certain segment of the population or a certain part of the community might not get as new a bus or might not get buses with lifts or something like that. And the intent behind this is that we're doing things to keep that from happening. And I can tell you that, yeah, we have all of our buses are, you know, equipped with lifts or with ramps and you know, it's but we need to have a program in place. And then we also, part of this program is that people can register a complaint. And there's a process that we will go through to research that complaint, you know, validate it if it's valid, rectify it, or deal with that. So what we've done is, starting on page 5, is the checklist that we use in making sure that we've done everything to comply with this. And Curtis has gone through and he's put NA by the areas where that's not applicable. We don't fall under those criteria. But this program is one that we've submitted to you in the past 3 years ago that's been approved. I would say with this one, we've done a little bit more in our outreach efforts. So we're doing more to, I'm getting that confused with a different program. Sorry, we run too many. Anyway, this is something that we need to bring before the board to get your approval. We actually have until next month to get this approved. So we are asking you to consider tonight. If you feel so inclined to approve it, great. If you need another month, we'll come back to you next month with it.
According to this, we already
did it. Did we not change the date? Is that what you're saying?
No.
Oh. Yeah, we would change that if you don't adopt it. Curtis is being very efficient, Jeannie.
It's pre-learning.
It's not adopted until you adopt it, so... But any questions that I can answer for you?
That's called preloading.
I do have one. Is Title VI limited just to race and skin color? There were some forms in here that kind of isolated it just to that, like the complaint form.
Yeah.
The complaint form is at page 15. I can't remember where I saw it. Oh, page 7. Sorry. Page 18. You know, I would experience discrimination just because of my race or color or national origin.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought Title VI was a little bit broader than that, but I don't know.
This is the plan. I do know that there are other things that are not related to Title VI that are criteria, sexual orientation, that type of thing.
Is Title VI just limited to race?
For the FTA purposes, this is the requirement. So it may not have reached that far yet. Correct. The reason we're bringing it before you is that we've got everything ready to go that we need to do to make sure we're in compliance. But one of the things on the checklist you'll notice is that we need to have the board approve it.
Okay.